This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, October 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Colin Powell, the four-star general who served as the national security advisor to Ronald Reagan, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and Secretary of State to George W. Bush, died this week. Powell was a Vietnam War veteran who spent 35 years in the military, and that experience drove his belief that the United States should intervene only in situations where victory was almost certain and the exit strategy was clear. But the plain-spoken Powell, deeply admired by Americans for his prudence and integrity, will be remembered most for the speech he gave to the United Nations Security Council in 2003, just before the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
We know that Saddam Hussein is determined to keep his weapons of mass destruction. He's determined to make more. Given Saddam Hussein's history of aggression, given what we know of his grandiose plans, given what we know of his terrorist associations, and given his determination to exact revenge on those who oppose him, should we take the risk that he will not someday use these weapons at a time, in a place, and in a manner of his choosing, at a time when the world is in a much weaker position to respond? The United States will not and cannot run that risk to the American people.
Powell's speech had the effect the Bush administration intended, garnering support among previous skeptics for the invasion. The war in Iraq became one of the biggest military calamities in American history. There turned out to be no weapons of mass destruction. Thousands of U.S. soldiers and more than 100,000 Iraqi civilians died. An unstable region became a haven for new terrorist groups, and public trust in our leaders was eroded to historically low levels. Dexter Filkins, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss how Powell helped to shape post-Cold War foreign policy in the U.S. and what his career reveals about America's ongoing conflict with Islamic fundamentalism. Hi, Dexter. Welcome back.
Hi.
Most of us remember Powell for what came to be called the Powell Doctrine before the Persian Gulf War and for his role in the George W. Bush administration. But as I mentioned, he'd previously had a long career in military service. So maybe we should just start by you talking about his experience in Vietnam and how it came to shape his understanding of war and politics.
Well, you know, first we should just say, you know, he's such a great story. It's such an amazing American success story. You know, the son of Jamaican immigrants, grew up in Harlem and the South Bronx, went to City College. It's an amazing story. And then he joined ROTC and found that he loved it, and then ended up in Vietnam, where he did two tours. You know, first, I think, in the early 60s, in the beginnings of the American intervention in Vietnam, and then at the height of the war, I think in 68. And he distinguished himself. You know, he was in, I think the moment where he clearly distinguished himself, he was in a helicopter and the helicopter crashed, and he pulled his commanding general out of the wreckage. And so a decorated war veteran, but I think the lesson that he took from Vietnam was no more quagmires. And so if the United States is going to go to war in the future, it should only go to war when it absolutely has to. And when it does, it should only go in with absolutely overwhelming force to basically bring it to a close as quickly as possible. That's the vision for America's military policy that it came out of, shaped by Vietnam and kind of brought to the United States foreign policy at the end of the Cold War.
And he had a gift, too, for speaking extremely clearly and bluntly. So maybe tell us a little bit about the invasion of Kuwait in 1991.
And yes. His statement. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. You know, if for everybody that doesn't remember, you know, Saddam sent his army into tiny Kuwait, which is, you know, sitting on top of an ocean of oil, and occupied it. And so President then Herbert Walker Bush said, this will not stand, and we are going to expel the Iraqi army from Kuwait. And Colin Powell who I at the time was a chairman of the Joint Chiefs in uniform. And he said, well, you know, here's what we're going to do. First, we're going to cut it off, and then we're going to kill it. Which is, again, I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It's so blunt. No one speaks like that. And that's exactly what they did, actually. They cut the army off, and then they basically destroyed it. And, you know, that was a fantastic success for American foreign policy. You know, it was this gigantic coalition. You know, the war itself on the ground only lasted like 4 days. I mean, it just couldn't have gone better. And so it sent General Powell's reputation to kind of sky-high levels.
He and also, he served under four presidents, which alone is remarkable. He was the first Black and the youngest chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the first Black Secretary of State. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how he navigated the relationship between the military and the president.
Well, so he, you know, he was a senior American commander at a very difficult time for the U.S. military, because it was in the decade and a half or so after Vietnam, which had been such a, you know, such a terrible calamity for the military and for kind of to be in the military. And Powell and others set about to kind of rebuild it, to kind of rebuild the military and to rebuild its morale. And then as the Cold War came to an end, which he also helped to negotiate peacefully and kind of, you know, with remarkable success. Then it was, you know, with the United States enters this kind of unique period where it's the lone superpower in the world. And it also just enjoyed, you know, really remarkably good reputation at the time. And so that that period essentially lasts for about 20 years. It lasts until 9/11. Of course, 9/11 changes everything. So you have this kind of really remarkable 20-year period at which Powell is at the height of his power, where the United States is alone at the top of the world.
He did prevail in the weeks after 9/11 by convincing Bush to strike al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan rather than going to war in Iraq, as some of his other advisors were telling him.
Yes, yes. I think, you know, If you look back on that time, in the hours and days after 9/11 began this conversation inside the Bush administration about striking Iraq. There wasn't any evidence that Iraq had anything to do with it, you know, that Iraq was in any way a threat to the United States connected to the 9/11 attacks. But the first evidence inside the presidential administration of this obsession with Saddam and with unseating Saddam and getting rid of him. And I think it's fair to say Powell was acutely aware of that obsession, which he found, I think it made him very uncomfortable, and he pushed back against it. I think ultimately he lost, and I think, you know, and we can get to this, but was ultimately used to further the objective of getting rid of Saddam. But the record is pretty clear that Powell was deeply skeptical of the early attempts, you know, at right after 9/11 to get involved in Iraq.
He would have seemed to have had the qualities of a strong statesman. He became George W. Bush's Secretary of State, and he was pretty quickly politically outmaneuvered by the hawks in the administration, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney. Could you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
I think it begins with how well the Afghan war went in its initial phases. Like the United States toppled the Taliban very quickly, and the Taliban seemingly disappeared. And so it was, you know, at the time it was like, wow, this is easy. Let's go to Iraq. Powell was skeptical of that from the very beginning, but I think the real power in the White House, which was and in the administration, which was Cheney and Rumsfeld, wanted to take down Saddam. They saw their opportunity. They wanted to make it happen, and they did everything they could to make it happen. And I think what that meant was essentially boxing out Colin Powell or maneuvering him or using him in a way to further their own purposes. But with the climate in the United States at that time, which is like the mood was, we got to hit somebody, Powell just couldn't carry the day.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The Bush administration exploited Powell's extraordinary popularity by using him to make its case for the Iraq War. What do we know about how Powell came to hold up that little vial of white powder as supposed proof that Saddam had nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons?
Well, it's an incredible story. It really is. I mean, first, I should say, just about that pressure on Powell, there's a great line, and I think it's in Powell's memoirs, where Cheney says to him in the run-up to the Iraq War, look, you're the most popular man in America. Use that popularity for something. And in other words, like, to cash that chip in, which he did. And so the story of how the presentation in the United Nations came about, the weekend before, Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and his chief aide, Larry Wilkerson, spent essentially the whole weekend in George Tenet's office. And Colin Powell basically walked in and said, look, I'm getting ready to go to the United Nations, and I'm going to make this presentation in front of the entire world. I'm not given any evidence that isn't totally backed up and totally solid. And so they sat there all weekend long. Larry Wilkerson slept on the couch in George Tenet's office. Like, they literally didn't leave, and went through the evidence bit by bit. You know, by Monday morning, they felt pretty comfortable. Like, this is pretty solid. You know, I, Colin Powell, feel pretty confident that I can go up to New York and speak to the world about this, which he did. And so, the enduring image from that moment, that incredible moment where he gives this, you know, long presentation, it's like more than an hour long, it's like 78 minutes, where he holds up the little vial of white powder and says, you know, this could be anthrax. You know, we could be attacked with anthrax because, you know, Saddam has the capability of making this. And Powell took this enormous popularity and credibility he had in front of the American people and kind of put it all on the line. And I had a long conversation with Larry Wilkerson about it, Colin Powell's chief of staff. And he said what we later learned was that the intelligence that had been kind of, we had vetted that weekend, a lot of it was just bogus. You know, a lot of it, the three or four sources that we thought we had, when we started to peel everything away, it all seemed to go back to one source. So we didn't have three or four sources. We really just had one. And the one was a source whose code name was Curveball, who, as I recall, and I might be off on the details, was brought to the United States by, I think, by German intelligence. And I think the really extraordinary moment is when Wilkerson told me after that presentation, sometime after, that he had a conversation, I think, with somebody in the German government who said, you know, we called you that weekend. We got in touch with Tenet's office and we said, like, you know, we're giving you a curveball, but, like, we're not vouching for that guy. You know, he's not credible. He's a nut. And that, you know, we're kind of hoping, you know, we're really surprised, you know, you went forward with it. And in Wilkerson's, you know, clear recollection, it never came up. You know, that's this incredible moment, like, in American history. It's like the moment when the United States decides to go to war in Iraq, and they're going through the intelligence, and there's, you know, the bat phone is ringing, basically, don't go, don't go. And, like, you know, the people who should have gotten that call, like, never got it.
Did you, when you were listening to that speech, what did you think?
I remember listening to that speech, and I, you know, it's Colin Powell, you know? I felt, as an American citizen, I mean, I felt reassured. I felt like, that's a guy you can trust.
Yeah.
You know, Colin Powell was such a kind of an extraordinary American figure that, and he gave an amazing presentation, and it was convincing, and he's convincing, and it was all of his credibility, and that's why this story it's a tragedy on both levels. It was turned out to be a tragedy for the United States and for the Middle East, and kind of this hideously executed war. That turned out to be unnecessary, but also a personal tragedy for Powell, because it's in the first paragraph of his obit.
Yeah. So the war in Iraq did depose Saddam, but essentially ruined the reputations of both Powell and George W. Bush. So talk a little bit about that and how Powell's position, public and private, on the war changed as the invasion played out.
You know, I was always a little frustrated with Powell because I felt like there was never a moment when he kind of stood up publicly and said, what a terrible thing I did and what a terrible mistake. And I was misled. And we didn't really get that. You know, we got sort of, this is a blot on my career, that kind of stuff. But we never got the kind of the full scale, I hate to use the word admission, but we never really got that from him. And, So Powell, stays on. We go to war in 2003. Powell stays on until the end of the first Bush term, and then basically he's pushed out. I mean, it's not entirely clear if he would have stayed, but they don't want him around. And of course, at that point, the war is sort of going disastrously wrong. And so again, the tragedy about this is that kind of all of Powell's doubts. The Powell Doctrine, all of it. It was right. He was right. And he set all those things aside to kind of enable the war to go forward. And so that's America, I think it's fair to say, I mean, the country's never really recovered. It's never recovered from that blow. And that, we only recently, just what, 6 weeks ago, finally got out of Afghanistan after 20 years. We still have troops in Iraq. The cost to the country's reputation internationally was just, incalculable.
You spent so much time reporting on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you talked to many troops. How was Powell viewed by the soldiers fighting the wars that he helped set in motion?
I think they loved him. I mean, I think ultimately, he was one of them, and he was it's such an amazing story. He's a guy that just kind of went from the very bottom all the way to the very top. And I don't think they held him personally responsible. But, when you're down there kind of on the ground fighting, it's like that's not when these things get debated, maybe when you get home much later. But I think Powell was basically adored by the, rank and file.
And you've talked pretty much about Powell's biggest legacies, good and bad. How might they help us understand the future of this country's foreign policy?
Well, I think, the Powell Doctrine being sort of only go to war when you have to, and when you go to war, just blow the other guy away. That kind of worked for a while. Like, it worked in Panama in 1989. It worked in the first Gulf War remarkably well. It didn't work in Afghanistan, and it didn't work. It certainly didn't work in Iraq. You could say Iraq was not a necessary war. Afghanistan probably was, but maybe not in the way that it was carried out. But the Powell Doctrine, just didn't have that much relevance there. Like, how do you attack a guerrilla army with overwhelming force that lives in the caves and mountains and in the desert? It just doesn't have that much relevance. So I think what when you go and sort of read about Powell's life in his career as a statesman and as a soldier, what you do come to appreciate is the restraint and the sense of judiciousness that he had in the exercise of American power, American military power, and diplomatic power abroad. And you miss that in a Republican. He served in all the Republican administrations, Democratic too, but he was identified as a Republican, and just that sense of restraint, you just don't hear it or see it anymore. And, I mean, personally, again, as kind of an American, I miss that.
Thanks so much, Dexter.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Forever War, about the American battle against Islamic fundamentalism in Afghanistan and Iraq. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron, Michelle Moses, and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.